Welcome to Education Talks, I'm David Burke. Dr. Gihan Jayawira is a general practitioner based in Melbourne, Australia. He also offers public speaking and training, with a particular interest in supporting teachers. I caught up with Gihan to ask him about his education journey in becoming a doctor, his HAPPY framework and how it can help teachers, as well as his podcast, Soul for Greatness. Dr. Gihan Jayawira, welcome to Education Talks.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much for having me.
It is great to have you on the show. I'm really excited about this episode. A little bit different. Can you tell us actually where are you at the moment?
I am in your old hood, Melbourne. Oh, were you from Melbourne, actually? You're from Australia, I know that. But
yes, no, I'm from New South Wales.
There you go. Well, your old rivals, Melbourne, Australia.
Yes, you know, I mean, being mistaken for a Victorian, there are worse things, I suppose. But But it is great to have you on the show. How are things in Melbourne at the moment?
Oh, look, it's the same as it always is, predictably unpredictable. So I was just telling you off air, like today, literally the last few weeks, we've actually had some really good, like sunny weather, but then today it's been cold and then it was sunny and then it hailed and then it was sunny again and it just hailed again. So it's Melbourne.
Typical Melbourne day, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Classic Monday.
Well, actually, at the moment, I'm in Bangkok, and apologies for the very low quality background and special effects here, because I'm actually going through a power blackout. So we're just using my laptop and hotspot, but looks okay. Actually, it comes up all right. Probably the less lighting and spotlight on me, the better. So it's great to have you here, just for the benefit of our international audience. So can you explain what a general practitioner is?
Yeah. So in Australia, I work as a GP and also now as like a coach and speaker. A GP or a general practitioner is essentially like a family medicine doctor. We are often called the gatekeepers of medicine. So we see everything, you know, from someone, you know, a baby that's a few days old to perhaps palliating someone in the nursing home who's 100 years old, and everything in between, from mental health to a rash to gout to alcohol addiction to a heart attacks, everything, literally everything. And yeah, we serve as the gatekeepers. So often we manage a lot of chronic health conditions, and we build a team as required around the patient to get them the best results, whether they need other specialists or other allied health like dietitians or exercise physiologists or physiotherapists, whatever it is. So I like to think of it's like the patient is like, to use a bit of a sports analogy, the patient is like your star athlete, and then you're sort of like their head coach, and you try your best to get the best out of them. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful vocation to have. Like, it's extremely rewarding. Yeah, one of my dreams come true for sure.
Now, you've also started to take a bit of an interest in assisting educators. You know, in addition to your day job, your very important day job, you're looking at doing a number of speaking and coaching items. You know, what sparked your interest, though, in working with teachers?
So teachers, I've always had a... Oh, no, that's a lie. I have a soft spot for educators, but I haven't always had one. So let me explain. So when I was at school, primary and high school, I didn't quite reflect on the value that the teachers were having on my life. It's hailing again. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
So adds a little bit of flavor to this this episode. So I didn't quite reflect on the value. So I just thought school was, you know, rock up, try to do my best, go home, try to get the best grades possible and get into medicine, essentially. That was the game I was playing for quite a long time. And then after I graduated, I started reflecting about my journey. And I realized that teachers, and in particular certain teachers, completely changed my life. One of them was Mr. Wheaton. So he was my maths teacher in high school. Lovely human being. Unfortunately passed away while we were in school. So that was an interesting experience, like going to your teacher's funeral when we were in year 12. And I just remember like bawling my eyes out. And I didn't even realize he meant so much to me until I went to his funeral. And there's this one moment, which he probably wouldn't have even remembered. It's probably just another day for him, where he saw me, like I was pretty okay at maths. So I was helping one of the other students with it who was struggling. And he just suddenly asked me to come outside to have a chat. I was like, okay. And then Mr. Wheaton's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm just helping. I'm pretty confident with this part of math, so I was just helping one of my friends. And then he's like, what do you want to do with your life? I was like, I want to be a doctor. And then he said, I think you'll be a great doctor. And that was it. I was like, okay, thank you. And then I still remember that, like, that was in, you know, more than a decade and a half ago. And I still remember that moment. And just reflecting back of having someone that you respect show that belief in you that's outside of your family and close friends. Mm-hmm. So that was powerful. And then Mrs. Slocum, who was this like tiny pocket rocket. She must have been like 3'3". I'm not sure how tall she was, but she was tiny. But she had like the personality of, she had a very big personality. And it seems like a small thing. Well, two things actually imparted, actually. One was she made us sit boy-girl. And that slowly helped me. I'm still afraid of girls, but that helped me a little bit, definitely. And eventually, I managed to marry someone, which is good. So thank you, Ms. Slocum. And on a more serious note, there was this person back at school who was heavily bullied by girls, by the boys, and unfortunately me at times. And looking back, I just cringe at how dumb I was and how immature. And she had this one session in our class where that girl didn't actually turn up to school. So we don't know why, whether it was because of the bullying or she was sick. But that was one of the most powerful speeches that I've heard from a teacher. And it was essentially telling us to stop acting like idiots, essentially. And she held us accountable and clearly outlined what we were doing. So there was no we couldn't argue against it. It was a fact. Mm. And that was like one of the big experiences that I had of, I guess, being held accountable, having consequences for your actions, being mindful of how you treat other people. So the irony of this, right, as I say it, Dave, is like, none of this had anything to do with school, in a sense. This was had nothing to do with maths, had nothing to do with English, which is my Miss Slocum's. This was about, like, I had this beautiful quote, don't let school get in the way of your education. Mr. Mm. Wheaton and Mrs. Slocum are there's more examples, but those are examples of them giving me an education. And I'm forever grateful. And then I guess reflecting on that, now having become a GP, I see everything. So I see all types of people, including teachers. And I see teachers, and they are, a lot of them are struggling, especially in the last few years. And there's something ethically, like morally wrong with that for me. And the problem I see, it really frustrates me, is that here are these people that are dedicating their careers to forging like our future, literally the youth, and putting in the time and effort and energy to grow these people. And they are, and then they come home and it's hurting them. It's affecting their health and it's affecting their happiness. And the tricky thing with educators is because they're so busy, we don't see them much because they're so busy. Like even if they wanted to, you know, they wouldn't necessarily come because they're just, it'll mean less, you know, it'll be another thing that makes them even more time poor. And what I was noticing is that within GP land, and now like outside with my coaching, and back a few years ago we were doing like well-being programs for schools, is that of course everyone is not the same, but there are common things that happen. One is that work gets more and more busy and more demanding for a teacher. So there's like a lot of stakeholders, right? There's like your students, their parents, your colleagues, the school leaders, and then the department, like the regulatory bodies. And all of that adds, the work commitments go up. But at the same time, so I see this much more than maybe people within the school would see, is that life doesn't stop. So all the other commitments go up. So family commitments, if they have kids, those commitments, it doesn't slow down just because work's busy. So you got like this dynamic where work's getting more busy, then life's getting more busy, and then touch wood, some sort of adversity happens. Life, you know, there is adversity always strikes at the worst time because there is no great time for it to happen, right? So it just happens. You add that to the mix, and then you get someone who is working their butt off in all domains and is becoming more and more time poor. And then the next thing that happens that I often see is that people start making, they start giving leeway to certain things. And often it's those things that are important, but not urgent. So important and not urgent. Things like your relationships, things like your health, things like your happiness. And then my why is, whether it's an educator or not, these people, they make these leeways or compassionate concessions. And then they might come in their late 40s or 50s and something big happens, like a health event, like a heart attack or a relationship breakdown, like a divorce or something big. And they start auditing their last 6 months to think like, okay, where did it all fall apart? And as a GP who sees like literally a 3-day-old to a 101-year-old, you can sort of play the game of scenarios. And I believe that those cracks start showing 10 to 20 years earlier. So if I can play a small role in coming in as the GP or coming in as the coach or speaking in front of a group of teachers or other, and just showing them the way I see it, the problem as it develops and how we can solve it, sign me up, because I'm, like I said, I mean, combination of the, it's just something wrong about it. I feel like if you give your all to help someone else, like your students, for example, you mm-hmm. should come home in a happier and healthier state.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, then something needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a parameter and standard we should demand and set and then aggressively go after. And I think there is a way.
Right. So you, it's very noble of you to be moving in this direction, doing a lot of these workshops and working with schools. One of the things that you talk about is this happy framework. Can you tell us what this is and how can it assist teachers?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I've described a little bit of the problem and what this all culminates in. So if you take this whole, like if I was to summarize it, you know, work gets busy, then life gets busy. Then you become more time poor and you start giving leeway to some really important things that are not urgent, but still very important. It leads to some form of unhappiness. And that can present in a lot of ways. It could be as simple as stress. People feel a bit low or sad, or people feel anxious or depressed. Some people feel quite hopeless. Not as a diagnosis, just as like a feeling or an experience. And the next step is often in that sort of compromised state, people are at risk of making some very big decisions, because especially when there's enough pain, and that one, well, some of those decisions could be leaving the job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had I was working with a teacher when we were doing well-being programs about a year and a half ago now, and we worked together for the whole year. Sensational teacher, like really cared about his students. Then right at the end of the year, he said, I'm about to leave. And I thought he meant the school, but he meant the profession, like, which is so sad that he couldn't find a way to, I mean, there's some level of unhappiness there, right? You wouldn't leave if you were happy. So, which brings me to the happiness framework. So I think the first premise is, I guess, setting a parameter that that you can have it all. And what I mean by that is achieve true balance. So I'll pose you a question, David, like what does work-life balance mean to you?
Well, I guess it means that you have the time to do the things that you need both at work and outside of work, and I guess you feel productive and happy.
Awesome. So I would add to that. So often when we talk about the work-life balance puzzle, the general discussion is work is too busy. There's not enough time for life. So I will drop my work commitments and then do more life stuff. So there's a compromise. I'm intrigued by having it all. So the happiness, the health, and the high performance. I think if you're excelling in all of those domains, for me, that's my definition of balance. So if we accept that definition, at least for the time being, you know, and we say we want to excel in all domains. So as for educators, for example, it would be educators, as a teacher, in your health, in your family life, in your contribution and service, community work, whatever, right? Once you set that parameter, so we accept that that's possible. That's number one. And then we reverse engineer what that could look like. So if the first thing that we need, one of the first things we need to solve is how we conceptualize happiness and unhappiness. So I often ask this question, and I'm going to ask you now, like, how do you define happiness?
Well, that's a very deep question. I guess I guess you tend to think of it as a feeling, right? You think of happiness as something that makes you feel a certain way. But I don't know whether that's the right way to define it.
That is the most common way. So happiness traditionally, you know, if you look in like the Oxford Dictionary, it's defined as like a positive emotional state that characterized by feelings such as joy, peace, contentment, life satisfaction, fulfillment. Mm-hmm. It's a feeling, right? It's a great definition. I just don't think it's useful. The reason is feelings come and go. They're fleeting. They're like weather. They're like Melbourne weather. You know, they come and go. So if you accept happiness as a feeling, or if we accept happiness as a feeling, then we also accept happiness as something that's fleeting and that will come and go. So from the get-go, the way we define it matters. And I would like to challenge this and think, okay, what if we set a parameter where we can be happy all the time? It's an audacious conversation. So I think the way we do that is to start by viewing happiness differently, starting to view it as a skill, as a verb, an action, and ultimately something that we do. The reason being, we can control our actions regardless of how we feel. Both psychological action and physical action. And if we can control it, theoretically, 100% of the time, definitely the physical action, there's a bit of the big mindset shift from trying to feel happy to trying to do happy. Now, this is not just a play on words. it's evidence-based. So to understand this, the first concept we need to grasp is the connection between feelings, thoughts, and actions. So what we feel, what we think, and what we do. So what we feel affects what we think and what we do. That's step number one. Step number two, what we think affects what we feel and what we do. And step number three is what we do affects what we feel and what we think. So if you picture like a triangle, feelings, thoughts, and actions, or feel, think, do on each of the corners of the triangle, they're all linked, but they're not all created equally. What distinguishes them is the level of control we have in each of those arenas. Mm-hmm. So if I posed it to you, David, like if I ask you to feel ecstatic now, can you do it? I mean, this is maybe you like podcasting that much that you are ecstatic.
Yeah, what if I'm already ecstatic? No.
In that case, angry, like say. Yeah, you don't seem angry at the moment. So anger. Can you feel anger?
Not really. No.
Yeah. Cool. So if I was to, let's look at thinking. So if I was to ask you to think of a fluoro green elephant, can you do it?
Yeah, I can see it right now.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Beautiful. So that suggests some control. And then the third thing is, you know, if I ask you to stand up and sit down, assuming capacity, you can do that. I know you recently got injured, but
you asked that question a few weeks ago, yeah.
So if we see the model for what it is, which is the feelings, the thoughts, and the actions all linked together, all affecting each other. And then we understand the parts of the model we can control and can't control. That creates a huge level of awareness. So I see this in play pretty much every day. So people will often because I do a lot of coaching within GP and separately as a coach, people would often come to me with how they're feeling. And it's usually something unpleasant. So I'm feeling anxious, for example, or I'm feeling overwhelmed. That's a very common one for teachers or educators. What they don't realize is that they're thinking anxiety and doing anxiety as well, often. So someone who comes to me feeling anxious, they might be thinking, oh, this is never going to end. There's way too much work to do. My boss is not understanding. You know, they're not supporting me enough. The parents are constantly on my back, whatever it is. So they're thinking overwhelmed. That's something someone who's overwhelmed would think. And they're also doing it. So, or not doing it. So like the doing it might be, I need to escape. So I'm going to spend X amount of time on social media, scrolling a newsfeed, or I'm too busy. Therefore you don't do something. So you might not exercise. You might not sleep well. You might have too much screen time before sleep. So yes, if people are feeling something unpleasant, it's really useful. Yes, I mean, we can accept the feeling, but we also know that we can't control it and that it's fleeting generally. But if we look at the fact that we're thinking and doing it as well, it provides it's very empowering because you can look at it and be like, well, I can think better and do better. So the next layer to that is, okay, cool. If I want to feel better, then a logical step is to say, okay, what would I rather feel? So a lot of people who are overwhelmed, they crave like a sense of peace or contentment or clarity because often their mind is just so scattered. So let's take peace. So what would someone who's at peace think or not think? And there's a lot of things we can do there. But the low-hanging fruit is the action. So what would someone at peace do? Well, they might meditate for an hour or 30 minutes or whatever, or they might go for a walk in complete silence, or they might read a book, even though they have a lot of stuff to do. So, and then if you look at someone who's often really anxious or overwhelmed, they're not doing any of those things. So I guess shifting that mindset from feeling to doing, even the thinking, the psychological action, so I call them like think, do strategies, is potentially life-changing.
Mm. Now, can I add, this is not to discount like legitimate perhaps stresses and worries, but this is a way to better take action or to better handle, be able to sort of like, I guess, function more effectively and end up on a pathway to where you want to be. Would that be right?
Correct. It's not to discount anything. It's more to challenge people on what's useful.
Mm.
You know, whether it's a legitimate worry or not, at the end of the day, now what? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And the quality of our thinking and the quality of our actions, or even more simply, the quality of our actions will dictate the quality of our results.
Yeah.
So not the quality of how we're feeling in any given moment or thinking directly. It'll contribute because we know how it's all linked. But at the end of the day, we need to do or not do certain things to get certain results. And often when we use the feeling, how we're feeling as a gauge for the actions we take, it can be misleading.
Mm-hmm.
But if we reverse engineer from, well, what is it that we actually want in this situation? So for you know, a teacher that's overwhelmed and thinking about leaving, a lot of them, I would think what they want is to do more of what they love doing, which is teaching, you know? Which is great. So if that's the lens that we use, or that's the frame that we use, we can reverse engineer the actions required to get there and the thinking. Mm-hmm. But it needs to start with that level of awareness of, you know, how we make decisions and how our feelings affect our decisions and how the rest affect our decisions and consequent actions and results.
Yes. I sort of think of perhaps how people make decisions. I'm thinking of teachers, not myself, but teachers who've, you know, perhaps moved on or left a school based on feeling and then moved somewhere and are in the much the same situation that they're not happy with. And it's more around perhaps what have they, you know, their decision to move was not necessarily the right thing, because perhaps they were not in the right not in the right way to sort of be able to deal with these frustrations which they can't control, which are going to appear in lots of different settings. Quite fascinating.
Agreed. I think a problem I was I was recently speaking to someone who was thinking about moving jobs. You know, she wasn't enjoying her role anymore, feeling a bit burnt out. And at the same time, you know, she hadn't exercised in months, and she acknowledged that exercise generally is like a really important piece of the puzzle for her. She loved reading, hadn't read in months.
Mm-hmm.
Loved time to herself, hadn't had that in months. And I just challenged her, and she was thinking about leaving her job. I just challenged her on the quality of the decision she would be making in a quite a compromised state.
Mm-hmm.
Because she'll be feeling, let's say, burnt out, but she's already also doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just even at the very least, getting the basics right, you know, sleeping pretty well, eating pretty well, exercising daily, if at least regularly, what does that look like? You know, that's a good platform to go off. And I sort of look at it, I don't know if you ever read the book Hatchet. So that was one of our books that we had to read in school. Sorry to say this to you, Dave, but I really hated reading in school. I love it now. I can't stop reading. But I was the same in high school. Yeah, I never really understood why we had to read these like old books. Nevertheless, that for me, like, you know, Hatchet was my favorite book. It still sucked, but it was my favorite book. It was like a 3 out of 10. Anyway, there's this it's about like a 15-year-old kid who's on a plane. Plane crashes in the middle of the jungle, and he's the only survivor. And he, with his hatchet, learns how to survive by himself. And one of the skills he learns is spearfishing. And so he stands in the water. It's like clear, beautiful water. He can see the fish. So he sees the fish here. He's like crafts his own spear. And he aims at the fish. And every time he misses. And then later he realizes he's not adjusting for the refraction of light. So he realized that if he went to the right and up, if he aimed there, he would get the fish. So this do happy framework is very similar. You know, often people aim at the feelings and they want to feel better, but aiming to the right and up at the thoughts and the actions, the irony is you'll get the feeling as well. It's just, I challenge people to just question what they're aiming at. And I invite people to just try aiming just to the right and up a little bit to see what happens.
That is fascinating. I can see that being certainly something that would be of great benefit to a lot of educators. Dr. G, you're also the co-host of the Soul for Greatness podcast. How long have you been doing the show, and what's the most interesting thing that you've learned doing it?
Yeah, that's been such a fun project. So I started that with my co-host, Buddhima. So we're actually old school friends. Mm. We hadn't seen each other for like 10 plus years, and then we randomly ran into each other at a restaurant. And I sat next to him and we just started talking. Like we just took like where we left off. It just continued. Yeah. And they were like, wow, we have a lot in common now. So eventually it led to this podcast. I think the first episode went out September 2021.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, it's been great. We have, you know, over 30 episodes now. There was some really arbitrary statistic. Apparently most podcasts don't go past 20 episodes. So I guess we're not like most podcasts now, but like, hopefully, I mean, we don't see an end to it. We are enjoying it so much. And to your question of like, what was the best experience, or what have I learned? Is that right?
Yeah. Like what's been interesting doing it? What's the takeaway at the moment? Big lesson.
There's so many. I think I'll give you a few. The first one that comes to mind is that the value of a conversation with someone, how much you can truly learn if you're curious. And number two, how generous people are to donate their time. So I think a lot of people look at our podcast and think, wow, how did you get these, you know, we have such a beautiful range of guests from moms to other, like, yeah, working parents, to CEOs, to Australian of the Years, to people in middle management, like everyone. And people ask, like, well, how did you get such good guests? And the answer is simple. Like, you just ask. Like, people are just generally willing to help if they can. And that's been a really big learning. And I guess when you say it out loud, it makes sense, right? Like, if someone was to ask you for help like that, David, like, you'd probably say yes, right? Like, why not? Like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Why not help out? So that's been great. And also just the pure joy of doing it with a good friend. Growing together, you know, I think we sharpen each other. There's things that I'm very good at that he probably learns from, and there's things that he's very good at that I am actively stealing from him. So it's been a great journey. I think I would say if anyone who's listening is even the slightest bit curious and likes having conversations and likes asking questions, you should absolutely do a podcast, even if no one listens. If no one listened to our podcast, I would still do it. The return on investment is ridiculous. Like, the amount of beautiful people we meet, the conversations we had, it almost doesn't matter. It's like just a bonus if people listen and enjoy it.
Yeah. You recently had your former school principal on. That was a really good episode. Yeah, that was really great to listen to. Yeah. What was, how did that come about? How did you reach out to and just asked him to come on the show?
Just asked. Yeah. Just asked on LinkedIn. I had him on LinkedIn for a little bit, but just asked, said yes, no hesitation. But that was a cool one because we wouldn't have been able to have that conversation back at school. We were just too immature. But now, like, we can actually ask him some big questions and I guess be worthy dance partners to Mr. S.
Well, it was a really great one, certainly for an educator, and listening to him talk about, you know, leadership of a school community just reminded me of some principals that I'd both worked with and had as a student myself. Really good link. In fact, I'll put a link to that episode in the description so people from Education Talks can have a bit of a listen to that as well. Now, Dr. G, how can people reach out and connect with you if they're interested to learn some more about what you can offer for schools?
Yeah, absolutely. So feel free to reach out directly on my email. So it's drg@drgihan.com. And if you do reach out and you do remember, put in the subject line, let's dance education talk. So I know where you're coming from. My website is drgihan.com, and I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I try to, my aim on LinkedIn at the moment is to try to be the most, try to not waste any words. I want to be really, which is ironic to say on an education platform, but like, yeah, to really get back to my English roots and be concise and get a message across in just efficiently. That's been a fun journey. Cause I think I can't remember if I told you, David, I'm writing a book about this framework, the Do Happy, what's called Do Happy. So a lot of the insights, this little snippets I'm just sharing. So if anyone wants to follow, please, that'll be awesome.
Well, that'd be fantastic. So look, Gihan, it's been fantastic having you on today. Hopefully down the track, we might be able to catch up again. But thanks so much for today being on Education Talks.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this episode of Education Talks, please do share with your friends and colleagues. Don't forget to stay subscribed to catch each new episode.